It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hello, Ken Bergen here from Hospo Reset. Today I'm talking to Sean DeVries. He's from Open Pantry Consulting, and we're going to talk particularly about how to be a successful restaurant and food service consultant. Sean's background's in baking and lots of areas of food service. He'll explain that a little more detail, but I know he's pretty much in demand now for consulting work. And I think that's something that's on a lot of people's minds as they're thinking, especially chefs, you know, they're thinking my knees don't work anymore, or I'd like some weekends off, or all sorts of other attractions about a life after cooking. And a lot of restaurant owners maybe, you know, sold their business, restaurant managers, lots of baristas, lots of people have that thought as well. So we'll go to the expert. Hey, Sean, great to talk to you today.
Hey, Ken, it's fantastic to be on your show. You do amazing work for our industry, so I feel really fortunate to be on today.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'll share the compliment because you're a podcaster as well. What number are you up to? In the hundreds, aren't you?
You've been. I recorded yesterday, as we're recording this, episode 174.
Wow,
which will go out in February. Yeah. So really, 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 really lucky to have.
Yeah. What's the podcast called?
So, Principle of Hospitality. Yeah. So, if you search for that, you can find it.
But, great. We'll put the link to that in the show notes as well, for sure. Awesome. So, your background originally was in baking. And I mean, boy, is that brutal hours if you're not used to it. Did you do your apprenticeship in that area? Or tell us a bit about your background, your career, how you developed.
Yeah. So I'm coming into my 25th year in the industry now. So originally from Adelaide, I'm living in Melbourne at the moment, and became a baker's assistant at the age of 16. So I always wanted to be a chef, and went for an interview with Hyatt Hotels when I was 15 to try and be an apprentice chef. And they said no. And I was a bit bad and bruised by that because I thought I really wanted to be a chef. And There was a Bakes Delight bakery that was opening up around the corner from me when I was 16 and doing year 11. I got hired as a Bakes assistant and working on the weekends and basically helping the bakers do their job, and was doing that sort of 16 hours a week on the weekend and a cleaning shift on it during the week after school and sort of learned my trade that way. And when I finished year 12, I went full time and became a baker. And then I was fortunate enough to have a boss who was just exceptional mentor and leader for me, sort of showed me the path to business ownership as well. And I bought a bakery, Bakes Delight Bakery, at 21, and then a second one when I was 25, 26.
So you had that experience of a second business where you can't be hands-on.
Correct.
In everything, yeah.
Yeah, exactly right.
How was that? How was the learning to let go and delegate then? Were you doing
really
that
tough
already, or?
No, look, really tough. Any young guy who's sort of mid-20s who's doing that kind of stuff naturally has an ego and is a bit arrogant. Mm-hmm. And I was classic case for that. And
so a 48-hour day rather than a 24-hour day.
100%. Yeah, I was literally working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah. There was a period in time where I worked, because I needed to financially, I worked for 4 months straight every single day. And I was doing, you know, everything from obviously baking, but to recruiting staff, training staff, serving out the front, all the bookwork, everything was involving myself. And when I got the opportunity to take a second bakery on with Bakes Delight, like, I had to learn how to delegate. And that was, you know, I was really fortunate to get that kind of opportunity really early on.
I suppose that franchise system, they would be set up to enable that, would they? Did they have the best systems for that, or would they really depend on kind of single owner operator?
Yeah. It depends on the site. So if you've got a site that, you know, is doing sort of below sort of $10,000 a week in turnover, then it's really built on the franchise partner or franchise partners being there every day and being part of it. So in bakeries, you know, $20,000 a week and that kind of stuff, really good numbers, then you need to start to work through people. And that's where you sort of use the same sort of systems. You just do it through people rather than through franchise partners. Mm-hmm. That was a good thing about the Bakes Delight system, was the fact that the franchise training could easily be adaptable to right. manager training and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, I guess that you've sort of the lessons you've learned about systems and implementation have been ones you can duplicate, you know, not copying, but just that sort of mindset as well. Oh, yes. And, you know, personally, I've seen so many, what I call, I know Baker's Delight is just straight bakery, not bakery cafe, but that Correct. Bakery cafe model I see is very resilient, especially in sort of rural areas or, you know, yes. out of trendy inner cities where we just got to pumping out lots of good baked goods and sit down and have salad on the side of your quiche or as well. And,
so you feel a bit better about the pie. Yeah.
That's right.
No, I totally agree. I think for bakeries, it's all about romance and it's a bit about nostalgia, right? Like most young kids will have a memory before the age of five of being in a bakery with their parents. And I think that really never leaves you. And I think that's why bakeries have now jumped ahead and become hot property again, especially in the Eastern Seaboard. Like it's really good to see.
Yeah, nice. Well, let's get into the consulting work. So I guess people sort of, you're out and about and, you know, you're quite active on social media and, you know, podcasting and all sorts of things. So you meet a lot of people and I'm sure others say to you, you know, how do I get out of this? How do you do it, man? How do I kind of hang up the apron and just work Monday to Friday? I'm sick of being a chef. What's one of the first things you say to them when they talk to you?
I usually ask them why they're sick of doing the role they're currently doing. Because sometimes it's not about the job they're actually doing. They've just fallen out of love with the job they're doing, maybe because of who they're actually working with. And, you know, I've been fortunate during my career to work with a number of different brands, some really big, some independent, but mostly all really positive experiences for my career. And I've been really lucky with that. And that's what's kept me in the industry for such a long time. So I usually ask them that because going as a consultant, starting a consultancy brand is tough because you have to change to, you know, working for yourself and making sure that you can have enough money to survive and be financially secure. Like it's a really big leap of faith. And if you're really good at what you do, but you don't have the skill set to then train that and implement that in either staff or owners in strategy, then it becomes quite tough. So usually I ask them, you know, no different than when I talk to an owner, like, what do you want the outcome to be? What do you want to achieve from being a consultant? Why do you want to make that change? Because you need to make sure you really want to do it before you do.
Yeah. And if you're wanting to make $100,000 a year, we've got to work backwards from that. And we might talk in a minute about the financial side and, you know, I want to talk about charging and all, cash flow and all those important things. Yep. You mentioned skills. So a lot of chefs, you know, they're very quick and agile and very well organized, or they don't survive. The same as, you know, restaurant managers and owners, they're kind of good jugglers, but you actually got to have different set of skills, I think, for consulting. Well, what's on your list of skills that I need if I'm going to start consulting?
Sure. I think the first thing you really need to understand is a P&L. I was really fortunate in the early part of my career and before I even got into bakeries and running my own businesses was the fact that I understood P&Ls because my parents owned food businesses when I was a kid.
Right. So okay.
I understood how P&L worked. I understood
Mum
about
did the
tax.
Bookkeeping.
Correct.
Yeah. My mum did the bookkeeping for my father. He was a builder, but it's just like that's
same thing, right? It's all about people. So I understand payroll. I understand taxation and accounting quite early on, had exposure to accountants and how that worked. I think as well, like technology has taken a leap in hospitality the last 2 years. A lot of venues were so far behind technology and now it's just fast forwarded so quickly that you really need to understand hospitality technology and how that's going to change the game moving forward when we think about things like order at table or taking, you know, cloud-based point of sale systems, like all these things which are going to become normalized.
Rostering,
yeah, all those kind of things which are now becoming normalized. Like you really need to understand that.
Right, so I really need to be, if I go to a client, I've got my list of half a dozen must-have apps or systems that, you know, I've got to kind of guide the implementation because chances are they're kind of nervous about it or done it badly or often
just
not at all.
Yeah, that's right. So we do a lot of work in the back end in with our tech analysis and tech stack to make sure that we're across not only like the different sectors, whether it be rostering platforms, whether it be order at table, whether it be stock taking, but also the new tech that's coming through.
What do you see as new things that you're having to watch?
Oh, I think order at table is obviously a no-brainer. I think that's definitely going to come through as being very normal across different segments. Obviously, you're seeing that through pubs and bars. Now you're seeing it come through to more QSR, fast casual restaurants, and also cafes. Firstly, it was because of, you know, increasing basket size. From now, it's about staffing and the lack of staff front of house. So I think that's a bit of a no-brainer. But things like rostering platforms and those kind of things, making sure we understand that technology stack to fit in the different business, because not every piece of tech is going to work in every single place. Like every rostering platform is not going to work in a cafe or a restaurant across the board.
Yeah.
Some need to be a smaller version of it.
Which is the rostering platform you seem to recommend the most?
Probably Deputy still. I think they do a lot of good work in updating their, doing updates generally. And I think price comparison wise, I think they're pretty solid. I think Tanda's done a really good job as well in for the venue that's sort of under $15,000 a week, kind of a good kind of resolution to put into venues
as
well.
It's quite a competitive field now, isn't it? Which is good. Yes. They're all kind of chasing each other with features. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you've got to be on top of that in regards to consultancy as well, because depending on what kind of funding these brands have, you need to understand what they're doing in regards to their updates for their customers.
So I need to be obviously good at my trade. I need to be across maybe half a dozen, you know, technology platforms that do different things and have recommendations, and then see through the implementation and hold the hand of the chef or the manager who's a bit nervous and the owner who's terrified and all those kind of things about it. And then, of course, the integration of it, because we've got to have the bookkeeper, you know, working so everything's flowing in the right directions and getting the good quality reports every week. What else? What around people management? I mean, if we can find people, well, let's assume we've got enough people. What does our consultant need to be able to do there?
I think they need to have an obvious understanding of how to recruit properly and how to know what kind of talent is right for different venues.
Do you do the recruitment yourself usually, or do you use a recruiter usually?
It depends on the client. Usually with the recruitment that I do, usually it's myself. Sometimes in the good old days, Ken, of a couple of years ago, like I would use someone else to filter through resumes. Now it's not that necessary, right, because we don't have as many people coming through. But it's up to me, the kind of people that my clients want me to try and get, whether that be restaurant managers, GMs.
And have you developed like a testing system or some standard checklists for that sort of thing? Is it still a lot of your kind of gut feeling around?
I try not to be. Sometimes it is gut feel for sure. I used to have like a checklist of, you know, questions you'd ask and all that kind of stuff. But I find, and even, you know, how I'd look at someone's resume and all those kind of things. But I think when you find, especially when you're doing so many more interviews virtually, that you really need to just see how that plays out and see where a conversation goes into regards of what kind of questions that I'm going to ask. Of course, there's going to be all the standard questions about your experience and why did you, you know, situational questions. But more often than not, you're trying to find out about that person generally and how to then figure out how they're going to handle particular situations with that client.
So this will be on a FaceTime or a Zoom call pretty much as fast as possible, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And then we'll move to an in-person with that owner or whoever I'm recruiting for, in-person as quick as we can, either as those two people together or usually myself involved as well, depending on the client's needs, and then move through. So now we're moving to probably, you know, two interviews rather than what used to be probably three or four interviews.
Really moving really fast. So interesting that you would say for the new recruit, for the new consultant, you really got to be ready to be a recruiter as well.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Because I think you said before you're more the QSR cafe, you know, high end, maybe executive chef positions where you might be able to afford $10,000-$12,000 fees for a recruiter because they're on a huge salary, but not within the mindset of most small operators paying those kind of fees.
Yeah,
interesting. Absolutely. And I guess that also includes some basic understanding of industrial relations and sign on and contracts and trial periods and wage rates and a whole lot of stuff.
Well, then I'll need to determine from the client how they're set up for success in that way, because some will have internal HR managers or payroll officers who have those kind of contracts in place, and they literally just don't have the energy to recruit. So they're just using me to recruit.
Okay. So you're just doing the first part, not having to set up everything from scratch.
Well, sometimes we can also do that and set up contracts for them as well, which obviously isn't, you know, extra costs involved in that, or partners. It really depends if they're a startup business and it's recruiting their start of their team, or if it's, you know, they've been around for a while, they just need to get some talent and don't have the time to go and get that talent.
Sure. So I guess a common question people would come to you is, you know, my food costs seem to be kind of way out of line, or my wage costs are way out of line. So that kind of the man with the axe, or the man with who's going to come in and make things more efficient. Is that a particular skill, or it's obviously a combination of different things? How do you approach those kind of, you know, when customers come with the ambulance light flashing?
I think you really need to look at how the business is set up by way of, like, who are the major stakeholders in the business? Mm-hmm. How many owners are part of the business? Who do I need to talk to as a consultant to make sure I'm adding value, to make sure I'm getting my communication across to the team? Right. And who are the key people in the team that I need to make sure I have a connection with in order to execute? Because the one thing you don't want to do as a consultant is do all this great work and then they don't use it.
Yeah.
Or they use it, you know, they use 25% of it.
Yeah,
you don't want that. That's not what people are paying for.
But that's what usually happens, isn't it? Or is it, are you lucky to get 50% or are you better than that?
Oh, I don't know if I'm better than that. I think it just depends on the client, you know. And I think sometimes it's just a case of making sure that you've built that connection with the team, and then you know, all those processes is just, just a function of that.
I remember talking to a woman who used to train consultants a while back, and she said the number one, for her, the number one thing was your personal relationship with the client.
Yes.
Had to be trusting, close, personal, friendly. It had to be, it had to be a very high degree of trust, because then you can chip them that, you know, they haven't followed through with something, or, you know, something needs to be done, that's how do we get that done quickly, et cetera.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, if you're, like, if you're doing a restaurant opening, for example, like, you've got timelines to hit, you've got councils that, you know, that need certain documentation, all that kind of stuff. Like, you need to lean on the client sometimes in order to get something resolved, something they can only sign. Mm. So you've got to make sure you have that, you know, friendly, professional relationship with them in order to make sure it's a value for them. Mm. You know, I want that client to come back in a year's time, a couple of years' time, and rebook me again because they've grown.
Yeah.
Not just take, you know, $10,000 or $15,000 or $25,000 and then it doesn't work.
Yeah. Like,
that's not a win for anyone.
So this, someone approaches you, and I was kind of curious. Sometimes they say, you know, hey mate, can you help me? How much do you charge?
Yes.
How much do you charge an hour? That sort of thing. But they'll always, they'd be the first, there's the email or the LinkedIn message or something like that. And I guess you've got to assess that this is a client that you can work with too. How do you do that? Do you find you can actually work with most people if they've got the money to pay you, or are you pretty selective?
No, I'm pretty selective now. I think I've been doing it long enough.
Yeah.
Like, before, you know, it was important for me to take whatever came because I needed to test and learn and understand.
Yeah.
Now it's a case of being more selective because I want to make sure that, you know, I'm the right fit for them as well. Like, it's really, really important.
So who are the people you less inclined to take now? What type of personality or type of business is it, or business structure?
Probably I usually don't go to businesses who have more than three owners as part of their business. Mainly
because are we talking family business then, maybe?
Just generally. Okay. Just generally. So because you have too many voices, right? Yep. And a silent partner is never a silent partner. So they, you know, when people are losing money, like, they want to understand why, right?
Yeah.
So family businesses are fine. I've had really good relationships with family businesses. It really just depends on the dynamics, who the key stakeholders are, what they want the outcome to be, and you know, how much, you know, where they really want to take their brand and if I can fit. So, you know, I wouldn't go and do consulting for a fine dining restaurant because I've never done fine dining before.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work. So sure. No matter how good I am, like it doesn't, they're not going to get the full value out of me working for them. As in if I did fast food, like there's a lot of things that I could do in fast food because I've learned it from QSR and I learned it from working really quickly in people development, but it's probably not my biggest skill set. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm happy to sort of play in my pocket.
So interesting, sure. I guess the person, the consultant who's just starting off, and I remember my own, I haven't really done much consulting over the years. I didn't really love it, I have to say. But, you know, you do take everything and then you gradually narrow it down. But, you know, you need money to start with and you'll just got to kind of dive in. So is there a type of personality you would say that's better suited for the role of consultant? You seem like a pretty calm, kind of measured kind of guy and obviously, you know, like numbers and like watching kind of the figure side of things.
Yeah, I think probably the most important personality trait is just to be really empathetic. So at the end of the day, like a lot of different personality traits work with different businesses, right? The cafe, the restaurant, the pub, they've got different businesses, different identities, different ownership. So different personality traits or consultants are going to work in those particular businesses. So I think empathy is the one thing which needs to be the common denominator because when I'm walking into someone's venue, they have spent $500,000, $2 million, $50,000 on that particular venue. So you have to be a really great listener and communicator and you do have to be patient. You do have to make sure that you can deliver clear and concise feedback in real time. Like when you start to build a deeper connection with your clients, they will usually ask you for your immediate feedback on certain things that happen, especially if you're live in a venue, because they begin to trust you and begin to really respect what you're thinking. So that's probably the empathy is probably the biggest thing.
Okay, that's good. So let's talk about this starting process again.
Sure.
Can you help us? And they get an idea of what, you know, how you charge, and then you want to put something in writing. And my experience was that whenever you ask them, what do you actually want? It was just like, relieve the pain, but getting people to actually write, a brief for you was almost impossible. I used to do like a reverse brief, give them a list of questions, just and oftentimes just get on the phone and do it that way. But what's your process to get putting a proposal together, and how long is the typical proposals, and what do you find now with works best?
So I usually get, so if an inquiry comes to me, then I'll usually do a 1 hour, hour and a half kind of brief with that client to understand where they're at, how their business is situated, what they want the outcome to be.
And sit with them or over the phone or Zoom or something like that?
Or either Zoom or in person. It really depends on where they're placed. So sometimes it's an interstate client. So it'd be virtually, but often than not, I try and do it in person just to try and understand from them, you know, face to face, even if that is virtual, what they want the outcome to be for their business, how they see it moving forward. And then I can really understand the value that I think I can add from my experience and the partners that I do have for their particular venue.
So
or
you've
their
got your brand. List of questions and checklist, I guess, that you want to go through and finding out finance, sort of broad brush financials and all those sorts of things.
Because then I can sort of understand from that in how much they could probably afford and how much value I could add for the amount of money budget I think they've got.
Yeah.
So obviously I've got a particular way of working and cost structure involved depending on what they want to take me for. So that's usually how it works. In regards to
what do you email them then? Is it like a contract or
So I'll do a proposal first. So I have a proposal which will basically set out what we talked about, clear objectives that I, from what I've seen from either the call or the meeting in person, and then obviously cost structure, and then when those are going to be achieved. So a timeline of we'd agree to that in principle. Once they've agreed to that, or they've got feedback which they want it to be changed, and a re-proposal done, then we'll move to a contract. Contract is signed, and then we'll get started.
Okay. And then is there half up front, or how do you structure payments? And what's a typical time? Is it, you know, you want to get it all done in 3 months or 6 months, or is it short, or and how do you manage the payment side of it?
Yeah, so I think it depends on the client. If it's a project, I'll ask for a 25% upfront, and then I'll move to different milestones during that project in order to get the rest of the payment. Usually, leaving sort of 25 or 30% till after the project is finished to make sure everyone's happy with it.
Right. Okay.
If it's more of a strategy piece where you've got me for sort of 12, 13 weeks to deal with different needs and that evolve in the business. So, you know, operational chats once a week, conversations about HR, people development, training, tech, all those kind of things. So you get sort of access to me.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a weekly charge. Okay. So that's just charged every single week over those periods of time. So that's probably been the best way that I've found to work the last couple of years, okay. Especially.
Okay, doing that on a weekly retainer.
Yeah, correct.
With a finite period.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So it's good for me because I get, you know, weekly amount of, and I know that client is going to continue to pay me, and it's good for them for their cash flow and that kind of stuff as well. And if they have a challenge in pain or whatever, then we can just pause it and then just restart again, which was something that I did for a couple of clients last year as we went into lockdowns, and maybe the need wasn't there from an operational standpoint. So then we need to do a recontract again and then change the terms of the agreement in order to move forward.
Yeah. Okay. So thinking about this, you know, what you'd recommend to the new consultant too around this sounds like, well, it's a combination of different approaches with different types of things, but we've got to, you know, people do need to have money every week to pay rent or mortgages or things like that.
Yes.
What do you suggest to the new consultant?
Show your value up front in order to get paid something before you start the project.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a way for that client to show you that they trust you and that they want you to do the work. It was hard for me. I remember my first client and I didn't do that and I didn't charge anything until the end of the project. And the project was probably about a month and I didn't get paid for weeks beyond that. You know,
you gave them a big fat bill at the end. And
yeah. It wasn't even a big fat bill. Like that was the other thing as well. Like it was well charged, Ken. They were just being disrespectful, right?
Yeah.
But they had all the win from me because they had everything they'd want and they'd paid nothing for it.
Yeah.
So make sure you're getting paid incrementally over the project period.
So recommending to our new consultant, but someone who's experienced in the business, well, what should they be thinking about as like a, you know, personally, I don't like hourly charges, but things do come back to hours or days or projects. What do you, sort of dollars would you suggest people, how they value their time?
As in how much should they charge?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a really good question. I think it's like how long's a piece of string.
You were expecting that though, weren't you?
I wasn't expecting the hourly question. I think, you know.
But would you say people should do hourly or never go down that track?
No, I would never go down hourly.
Good.
Otherwise, you're an employee.
Yeah.
I think hourly makes a lot of sense with a client because the client needs to understand how many hours you're going to put in and therefore what is the outcome going to be, right?
Yeah.
But you need to focus back on the outcome, not on the amount of hours to achieve that outcome. Because if I'm doing some council documentation for them for a new venue opening, I might find that the council who's going to take a lot longer with me than someone else.
Yes.
So therefore, if I'm charging that by the hour to the client, that could be 2 hours, that could be 8 hours.
And it also might take 6 months to get the thing completed because of council delays rather than
100%.
The 4 months that you thought, yeah.
Yeah, I had that recently at the end of last year. So with the council application. So I only charge I've got a day and then I've got, and then obviously a project. So I only charge per day or per project. So that's how I work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So usually you can get me, depending on how long the project will go for $750 a day, upwards of $1,000 a day for a smaller project. Mm-hmm. And then most of my projects.
That didn't hurt, did it?
Oh, so I'm ripping off a Band-Aid. And then, but most clients, you know, probably somewhere between sort of $8,000 to.
Yeah, well, it's a total amount.
$30,000, really? Right? Yeah, sure. So it really depends on the client.
Okay, no, that's really helpful guidance. Yeah. So there's some legal protection needed for you, and it's contracts signed, and is there insurance as well? What do you recommend around these things?
Yeah, I think if you're starting to get a bit bigger, I think things like indemnity cover is important. I don't do that at the moment because I don't think it's really. The value isn't really there for me, and the kind of
oftentimes too.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. So I think when you're starting out, I think having a good lawyer in place in order to get some good contracts done up when you start, I think is imperative. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like making sure you've got a great accountant, right? Like it's no different than what you say to your own venue clients. Make sure you've got a great accountant, make sure you've got a great lawyer, make sure you get some really good contracts drafted up, and don't really negotiate on those. Those are your terms, and that's what you want to stick to. So yeah, make sure you do that. But I think as the business grows, you can spend more time and more money on those things if you so fit. But I think unless you're starting to build a really big client base, indemnity cover isn't really necessary.
Good advice. So delivering reports, obviously, you mentioned one type of consulting might be, you know, weekly phone calls or, you know, attending a team meeting or something regularly. Is written material and spreadsheets and recommendations and things like that. What have you learned about the best way? Because you're often delivering this stuff to people who don't like reading stuff too, or don't, their email inbox is a complete disaster area.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you find the best way to communicate to them? No, maybe that's a better word, right?
Yeah, no, I understand. I think you sort of take your smell test at the start when you work with a client, right? How they're best taking in information from you. Sometimes that's phone calls, sometimes that virtually, most of the time it's going to be in person. So I think in regards to any final documentation with projects, which we largely always do with projects that we work through, we try to do that in person, face to face with the key stakeholders to make sure they understand.
So you're all looking at the documents together. Correct. And going through page by page.
Leads to less questions.
Is it as simple as page by page, or is it maybe on a screen, or what's the...
Probably both. It depends on how many people are part of it. If it's one-on-one, it's, you know, page by page. I'll send that documentation to them before the meeting starts. They've got some understanding. You're going to get less in real time, which is important. But otherwise, I'll have that printed out or show that on a screen to that client to finish off the contract, or any other key stakeholders, whether that be a chef, restaurant manager, that kind of thing. And sometimes it's a room of people. You know, sometimes it's a board of directors, something that's a bit bigger, or maybe some people who haven't dealt with you during that project. So you need to make sure that you're giving the same experience to everyone in that room. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really, really important.
Okay, interesting. So we've got another skill really around communicating to, you know, a room full of strangers.
Yes.
And with credibility. And there's another one too around the whole kind of written presentation, I think, too. You got pretty good at that over the years, I'm sure. And, you know, you went to school. I don't know what you were like with spelling and writing and things. But, you know, there's a lot of people, it's just not capital letters and full stops 100%. Just aren't a priority.
Yeah.
Especially if you're texting, you don't use that stuff anymore. But, you know, an illiterate looking document is immediately a sabotage.
Yep.
How does the new consultant, let's say, you know, someone who's a two-finger typist, they're a complete whiz in running a kitchen, they know to run a team, they're, you know, fantastic with cost control and all the rest, but when it comes to the keyboard, oh my God.
Mm-hmm. So what do they do in that situation? Yeah. I think partner with someone who can. So I've got a subcontractor who works with me every week. She does all the marketing and that kind of stuff for what we do with the podcast, but also she is a qualified chef. She'll work with me on product development and that kind of stuff as well. Mm-hmm. My partner does a really good job in looking at proposals that I do or contracts that I send out and final documentation as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm lucky enough that I can type out a document and articulate pretty well. I'm pretty fortunate in that. But having other people look at it and give you feedback, and as long as you're able to take on that feedback, is really, really important, because that is sometimes the only thing which a new person coming into that business will see of you. Like they haven't dealt with you.
Yeah, exactly. They've never spoken to you. There's just attachment to an email.
Yeah, all these recommendations.
There's that, and there might be a spreadsheet attached as well. So we need.
Know what you don't do well, or you're not as good, and it'll save you time and money.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily mean a formal business partner, but it's someone who is kind of your offsider to help with this sort of thing, and their time is valued and compensated. Yeah,
exactly.
Anything else around the reports that you give? You know, what do you find gets the best uptake, and you know the happiest customers, you know, what are they like receiving? How long should it be?
Sure. I think, you know, the shorter the better. I think the final documentation is really just a summary of what you've done for them project-wise, right? Mm-hmm. So it can't be I would never have something in that final document that I haven't told them about or we haven't talked about beforehand.
Right, so no surprises.
No surprises at all.
Okay.
So they really need to understand it. So it's just really a summary of all the work that's been done to leave any final questions or anything else they want to add to that document, and depending on how they're going to use it. So because they're going to shape your document depending on what it is, right? So I think usually no more than sort of 8 to 10 pages. Don't be too heavy on too much written content unless you really need to.
Lots of bullet points.
Yeah, lots of bullet points, you know, to have links away into spreadsheets and websites and all that kind of stuff is more than fine.
Yeah.
But don't add too many screenshots and all that kind of stuff to the document.
Before and after photos, or just photos to sort of highlight problem areas or things.
Sometimes if we're talking about if we're doing things like competitive analysis and we're talking about other brands, that's a visual representation is always important.
Visual industry, people are so visual. I've always found a little bit of a picture show in some situations.
Yep.
People really like that. Yeah,
I agree. It depends on the client and who you're working with. So some will want more detail, right? So if you're going to do more pictures, which is really, really important to do pictures and articulate in that way, as long as you've got context to why those pictures are there.
Because then the accountant might be there too, who is not a visual person. Mm-hmm. If you leave out numbers and percentages.
Yes.
She's going to look like a fluff piece. Kind of concerned,
What am I paying $10,000 for here?
Yeah. Do you ever get too attached to clients or hang around too long or get too
not anymore?
Involved
definitely used them? To.
Yeah,
definitely used to. Yeah, it's
got your heart broken by them, did you?
Yeah, financially. Yeah, so I've found it tricky when I've taken on clients and they paid me, and then a year later, they'll ring me back and ask me a question, and then it leads into a question which they should be charged for,
right?
And it's hard to then go, hey.
So like, we're coming.
This is advice
to
here.
The old scope creep thing too. Well, scope creep might be a year later they expect you to come back for free, but how do you manage scope creep within it? Scope creep meaning, you know, what you said, we're going to do these four different kind of parts, and they say, oh, actually, can you do some recruitment for us as well, etc.
Yeah, exactly. That's where the proposal document and the contract are really important, and making sure they agree to that and understand that, understand what you're going to do for them in the time frame, for the amount of money and what the limitations are. So sometimes you just really need to be black and white with those things rather than grey. There's going to be enough grey when you start consulting. So you need to make sure that you can revert back to those two documents in order to make sure that if there is scope creep, you can change the agreement.
Yeah, it's an interesting one too, because you sort of want to be heading it off early. I'm thinking scope creep, say when you know, I've had houses renovated at different times and you're saying to the painter, oh, actually, can you just do that extra little bit? And one guy is saying, yeah, mate, that's another $120 or something like that. It's just like, wow, you're on it, aren't you? I'm kind of slightly offended, but actually I respected the fact he was just very cut and dried.
So I think that's, as long as you have a really good professional relationship with that client, I think that's an easy conversation to have.
So we've hung up our shingle. Does our name, I guess, is enough really, isn't it? We don't have to have the kind of XYZ consulting, or maybe you decide a name or something, a fancy name or something like that, Byron Bay Consulting.
Byron Bay everything at the moment.
What's the kit, the marketing kit that I need to get together for my credibility?
Yeah, I think it depends on what your aspirations are. If you go into this with a partnership with someone else, or you're getting other people involved, then a brand name is a smart thing to do. That's why I did it for me. I also didn't want the business just to be about my name. So I wanted to add aspirations to grow it a bit bigger. So I think in regards with any kind of promotional marketing, that kind of stuff. So I don't use business cards. Obviously, I have a website. LinkedIn is where we sort of connected as well. Ken, I think LinkedIn is the most important platform.
Yeah. Well, you're very, very, you're really a daily communicant, aren't you?
Correct.
On LinkedIn. Yep. And most often, as I see, you're kind of sharing useful information. I think I take a bit of a similar approach.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, we sort of think, oh, that's going to be helpful to people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't lead back to your website directly, but it establishes your credibility as the guy who knows everything or almost everything.
Well, I think we both do generally the same thing, right? Like you just said, it's about credibility and it's about respect. And we've both been in the industry for a good amount of time and it's about showing people that we're adding value to them about hospitality and what we know, and we want to help the industry. And I think that never goes out of fashion. So making sure you can give your thoughts around what's happening in this industry is really, really important to building credibility.
Do you highlight projects that you've done? I haven't seen a lot of that.
Sometimes.
Depends on the client agreeing to it, doesn't
correct.
It?
Correct. Yeah, correct. Yeah, sometimes. We did a lot of noise around some product development we did last year with the bakery group here in Victoria. Uh-huh. They're doing a major...
Was their breakfast
development? Yeah, their breakfast range, yep. Mm-hmm. So they're going to go on a full marketing campaign in January.
So that was with their agreement, obviously, was it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Uh-huh. So they gave me the assets that they produced on the breakfast range that we did for them. And then, you know, it's only in their best interest for us to then share that as well.
So I guess it's an interesting thing to sort of be asking the questions about and knowing that people are happy with that from early on too, isn't it? Not right at the end.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Because they can feel pressured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah, I think that's really, really important. But yeah,
so the website. So LinkedIn number one, simple website. You write a few blog articles, I know, every now and again.
Write a few articles now and again, yes.
And what inspires those? Is it situations you see or just kind of brainwaves in the shower or what? How did they?
Yeah, it's a bit of column A, bit of column B.
Okay.
I think it's just a case of, you know, if I'm seeing something that's really important in the industry, if it's changing, obviously a lot of it's changed the last 2 years, which is probably why I've started to write more articles. But if it's something I think is not being written about, something I'm not seeing article wise that other people are writing, then I'll usually write it, especially if it's
I have to say, you know, when I was with Silver Chef for the couple of years till recently, all through COVID, it's a very exciting time to be writing and producing content and doing webinars. It's like, man, this is everything is new, you know.
Yes.
It's just like we had to have our wits about us like never. This was invention time. It was incredible. Yep. So,
totally.
Yeah, well, I broke my heart to see what was happening to a lot of people's businesses, but it was, exciting to be kind of finding solutions. Absolutely. Mm. What about should our new consultant be using Facebook and Instagram as well?
It depends on your client base. I think Instagram is from understanding what brands are doing and to make sure that, you know, you understand what cafes are doing, restaurants are doing in regards to dishes and shop fronts and all those kind of things.
Yeah. Okay. So it might be just a picture show of your sharp eye looking at, say, you've got an Instagram account. This is cool or this is amazing or that's a bit disappointing. Or
all that kind of stuff to see how brands are communicating, right? Because even though going to marketing consultancy as well, we don't really do that. But you need to understand how brands are marketing themselves.
Yes.
Because you will get that question. So
your clients want to know that you know what the industry is doing, don't they? They want to know that you're on top of it.
Credibility. But sometimes we'll get, you know, some leads through Instagram and that kind of thing as well, through the one we've got for the podcast and that kind of thing. So it really just depends. I would say just make sure that you give quality content when you put content out. That's been the most important thing that I've found. Funnily enough, I just had a conversation with the person I was speaking about before, the person who works with me about TikTok. So we're going to start to play in TikTok this year.
So exciting. You know, people get like, oh, I can't dance, you know. No, but I mean, some of the simple explainer stuff that I see there is just fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. So
lots of different industries. Yeah.
So I we'll start to do that this year and have a bit of play and see what happens. Obviously, TikTok is starting to age up a lot, but we think it's important as what we're talking about, recruitment and people development and those kind of things, which are critical for the industry. People coming into the industry need to understand what a good business actually looks like as well. So we'll probably start to talk about that too, which I think is imperative because we want, you know, our goal is to have people in this industry for a long time. As long as, you know, yourself and mine have been in the industry, like that hospitality industry is an amazing industry to be a part of and a privilege. And to make sure that people have a good start in their career is really imperative. So We'll share more about that this year as well.
The other part about that we both use pretty well, I think, is networking. I mean, we get out and about and we go to trade shows and we get asked to do things. And I guess sometimes people would look at those and say, how do those guys do that? You know, who do they know? Well, you know, it is about knowing people, but it's also about, not being shy at events and getting out and, being friendly and all those sorts of things. What are your tips for the new consultant?
Yeah,
be more kind of visible in those kind of ways and less shy. And
I did think about this. I think if you had a friend who was in the industry as well, I think bringing them along, if you're doing in-person networking stuff, which is a challenge.
Yeah.
I think bringing a friend along always makes it a bit easier. Yeah. Someone in the industry as well.
And then don't talk to them the whole time.
That's it. That's right.
Where we split up.
Yes. Sometimes you just need a push, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
But I find things like LinkedIn's a really good way to connect. And moving that connection into then messaging that person and just seeing if you can have a 15-minute chat with them over Zoom or over someone's phone.
I love it when people reach out with that sort of thing, or they're developing a new product and they just want to, you know, I personally hate the term pick your brains, but if they want to, you know, a bit of a discussion, I love that. It's just like, guys, do this more often.
Yes. And I mean, I do that with people and then people do that with me often, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then with the amount of content that, you know, obviously both you and I put out, Ken, from that you'll get people will then come into you and asking you to do trade shows and ask you to be part of events and ask you to do those kind of things, which is a privilege and super fun.
Yeah.
So I think it's just repetition, trying not to say no to too many things if you think they're seeing how it goes.
Whether that is a half-hour webinar or it's like a coffee meetup before a trade show on the second morning or anything like that, sometimes just put your hand and, you know, start pushing it on LinkedIn or something like that and you'd be surprised. People turn up, you know, it's just...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not about, you know, hiring a hall necessarily and doing all those sorts of things, but...
Yeah, I think thinking about meeting people around... the things you're already going to be at, I think, is important. I mean, we're looking forward to going to Fine Food Australia in Sydney in March, and I know that I'll, you know, connect, meet up with a lot of Sydney people while I'm there.
Yeah, so I think I'd say trade shows of different sorts are a kind of actually imperative for anyone who's in the consulting game, because you never know who you're going to meet and what you're going to see and take lots of photos and...
Yep.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of circling back a bit to about, you know, maybe that's your first article is, you know, 10 great things I saw at the Fine Food Show, you know.
Yeah,
it's a great 500 idea. Words down in no time if you, you know, the listicles like that, you know, are not so hard to write and suddenly, you're because a few words in a simple blog on your website, suddenly that's authority.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
It's a really good point.
Well, this is inspiring, Sean, to hear some of the secrets. Well, I don't think they're secrets, but, you know, some of the foundation steps that you've made to build your great reputation. Any other low-hanging fruit you'd say for someone who wants to dive into the consulting game to...
No, I think really just, you know, take risks. Try not to say no too often at the start. Mm-hmm. Just see what's going to happen. Even if people that you meet newly, like you don't think they're directly connected to the industry or anything like that, have a chat with them, understand suppliers and those kind of things as well. Like you don't know where those connections are going to go. Just try and build those relationships with people because they're the ones that are going to give you work longer on from someone who knows someone who knows someone who's heard about you.
Yeah.
That's really important. So credibility always matters. Mm. So just continue to build credibility every single day.
Yeah, fantastic. Mm. Great to talk to you. So if people want to find you, we'll put the link in the show notes as well. What's the best websites or you're obviously on LinkedIn as well?
Yeah, obviously on LinkedIn. So if you search for Sean DeVries, you'll find me, openpantryconsulting.com for my consultancy and then principleofhospitality.com for the podcast.
Beautiful. Cool. Terrific. Thanks.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hospo-reset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.